Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, more tales of Hunter and the Big Guy. It'd be such a great sitcom.
You're right. Like Jake and the Fat Man.
Something like that.
Amy Jacobson, Governor Pritzker story series.
Could go around solving crimes or something like Gumball and Gumball Beach Justice, something like that. Maybe put them in swimsuits. I like that. Joe Biden wrote college recommendation letters for the son and daughter of a Chinese financial executive with links to Hunter, despite the big guy repeatedly denying ever speaking with Hunter about Hunter's business interests. And we know from Ron Klain, White House Chief of Staff, over the weekend that, no, of course, Hunter didn't do anything wrong. And, of course, Joe Biden has no involvement. And whatever did transpire, that's just Hunter Biden's private business dealings. Emails obtained by Fox News indicate Jonathan Lee, the CEO of an investment fund, BHR, reached out to Hunter Biden and Hunter's business partners, Devin Archer, now a convicted felon, Jim Bulger, who is related to mobster Whitey Bulger, asking for help with Mr. Lee's son, who was applying to Ivy League schools, and ultimately his daughter. The great thing about this is the report says Joe Biden, not a sitting elected official at the time, but, you know, former vice president, I think he'd have some juice. He wrote a letter for Lee's kid at Brown. He wrote a letter for Lee's daughter to Georgetown. And according to New York Post reporting, neither one of his kids got into those respective schools. So there's how much weight Joe Biden has in academia, I guess. And BHR, why is that relevant? Well, in 2013, Hunter Biden introduced Joe Biden to Jonathan Lee, this guy who asked for help with his kid's college admissions. And according to an account of a BHR representative, this accounting firm he's the CEO of, the New Yorker, this BHR representative gave an account to the New Yorker in 2019. Days after the trip, according to Peter Schweitzer, who wrote the book Secret Empires, wrote the more recent book Red Handed, Rosemont Seneca signed a deal with the state-owned Bank of China to create BHR, which still lists Lee as its CEO and Jim Bulger as its director. So Rosemont Seneca was that private equity play that included Hunter Biden. They signed a deal with the Bank of China to create BHR, which Lee is the CEO of, and then Lee's asking for help with college entrance for his kids. But, of course, Joe Biden, being the, you know, unwitting four-decade U.S. senator and two-term vice president, wouldn't ask any questions about why Hunter was imploring him to write letters of recommendation for this Chinese official's kids, right? I mean, it's not like Joe Biden was involved in this in any material way. Well, that's a case that Peter Ducey took up with Jen Psaki.
There you go. Got to say it while you can, Dan.
Was it common for President Biden to do favors for Hunter Biden's international business partners, like writing college recommendations for their kids?
I've seen the report. I have no confirmation or comment on a report about whether or not the president, when he was a private citizen, wrote a college recommendation letter for an individual.
A college recommendation letter, though, from, at the time, a former vice president would be a big deal. So do we know what the president might have gotten in return for doing a favor like that?
Again, I have no confirmation of any recommendation letter the president wrote when he was a private citizen, by the way, not serving in public office. That's even the report.
But he's the president now, and you're his spokesperson.
Correct. And he was not the president at the time of this report.
So there's evidence that the president at one point was office mates with Hunter and his brother Jim here in D.C.
It's not accurate.
That is not accurate. So when Hunter Biden is emailing a landlord, please have keys made available for new office mates, Joe Biden, Jill Biden, Jim Biden, that you're disputing.
They were not office mates, no.
They were not office mates. Okay.
Great.
Okay. All right. Well,
that's all right. Wait, next question.
So you're just going to continue. Okay. You're going to continue lying to my face. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, then I guess we should just move on.
You in the back? Yes. Can I? Yes.
An email that says, "Hey, could you leave a spare key for Joe Biden?" I wouldn't. You know, it's all in the definitions. Does that constitute being an office mate? You know, that's an open question. And I love Jen Psaki's approach to these things too. I have no confirmation of that report. And Ducey says, well, you're the White House press secretary. Right. And I can't confirm that. No, no, I know. I wish you would have followed. Yeah, I know. But you're the White House press secretary. Is there anyone you could ask, like your boss, as to whether or not he did write those letters of recommendation and on what basis he wrote them? Is there any way we can find out an answer to this question, do you think, Jen? You got any ideas about how we might ascertain this information?
312-642-5600, turnkey Depo, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. No, the spokespeople, they always do the same thing, too. Like, if they don't answer the question, they'll say, well, we'll get back to you. And guess what? They'll never get back. That's right. Jen's the original. I'll circle back to you. Yes.
Well, and by the way, this has been going on all week because the other day in a similar press briefing, you had a similar exchange with Peter Ducey and Jen Psaki on the topic of Hunter and the big guy. And again, as with Ron Klain, I just wonder if these pronouncements are going to come back to haunt the Klains and the Psakis of the world and make them look like even bigger stooges than they look and sound at current.
On another topic, a lot of stories about Hunter Biden surfacing this week. So to ensure the independence of the investigation, would the president support the appointment of a special counsel?
Well, first, the president has never had a conversation with the Department of Justice about any investigations into any member of his family. He said that during the campaign, and he will continue to abide by that. So I'd point you to the Department of Justice for any additional steps they would take. They would make those decisions independently.
Is there any concern that they're not going to be necessarily seen as being able to make the decisions independently? If the White House Chief of Staff is out saying that the president is competent, his son did not break the law.
Well, that's something the president has said, and certainly we would echo. But in the same answer to that question, Peter, during an interview this week on ABC, Ron Klain also said the Justice Department is independent and they will make their own decisions.
And the president has said that he never spoke to his son about his overseas business dealings. Is that still the case?
Yes.
Oh, such a lie.
So
got
it.
Got the lie. Print. Cut. Save it.
Never Save spoke it. To his son.
No.
Never involved. Nobody knows who the big guy is. They weren't office mates. Okay.
And then,
all right, if that's what you're going to go with.
CBS News this morning. I mean, they were saying that there's 150 financial transactions involving Hunter or Biden's brother, James Biden, from their global business affairs that were flagged as concerning by U.S. banks. 150 different transactions. Nothing. And he never talked to his brother or his son about any of this stuff.
There were reports also with that a grand jury that has been convened in Delaware is asking witnesses if they can identify the big guy. Now, former Hunter Biden business partner in their Chinese ventures, Tony Bobulinski, did back before the election, said, I met with the big guy.
Yeah.
The big guy, we all knew who the big guy was, saved 10% for the big guy, and I met with the big guy in L.A. and so on and so forth.
Well, I hope he's being subpoenaed.
Okay. And, you know, there's not even any pretense. I mean, so what they're doing now is just saying, you know, Hunter Biden is an entity unto itself and we have no idea. They're just playing dumb. But right. The problem is that the Biden family, Biden Inc., has been leveraging Joe's position for personal enrichment for the better part of the last decade. And you can't undo that record. Peter Schweitzer's done a good job documenting it. Of course, the D.C. press corps is dutifully ignoring it best they can. And I think they're counting on an American public that just says, yeah, I mean, Hunter Biden's a scumbag. People are paying Hunter Biden to try to influence Joe. Joe is leveraging his previous positions to help his family enrich themselves and ultimately figured he'd get a piece of it after the fact. And you know what? That's just what we expect of politicians. So it's a shoulder shrug. If it's whether it's the Clinton Foundation or Biden Incorporated, that's just what politicians do.
Is it normal for your brother and your son to get, you know, monthly retainers from Chinese companies to the tunes of 100K? That's what Hunter got, according to CBS News. And his brother James got 65K. I
mean, yeah. And so what's that's the question.
Right.
The question is not, is it normal? The question is, are people inured to it? That's just what politicians do across the spectrum. And we make no distinctions. I mean, no one is rallying to the defense of Hunter and saying he is a well-respected, successful international businessman who brings real value to these enterprises and to the deals he's a part of. And that's why he has his own expertise, you see. He has his own skill sets, you must understand. And that's why he's so handsomely compensated. No one says that.
Right.
Not even the Biden family says that. And so it's obvious to everyone what's happening. And so what happens now? How do people process it? Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's one of two things. Now that Biden's safely in office, and whether he runs again or not, the journalists are writing the stories simply so that they can win the awards they love. Or is it two, are they ratcheting up the pressure to slowly convince Biden that he needs to resign using medical issues or whatever? And that as he stays there, they're going to ratchet up these stories more and more until he can't stay in office and they can replace him with Harris and then get a new vice president? Or what's the story here that they're releasing all the information?
Well, they're not. Thanks for the call, Bill. I mean, the New York Times confirming the existence of the laptop, a year and a half after the New York Post did. That seems to me like covering your ass, trying to frame anything that might be coming down the pike, like an indictment of Hunter Biden or more damaging stories. But I mean, I wouldn't say the D.C. press corps is really spending a lot of time reporting on this. You have the New York Post continuing to do the work they started before the election. And then you have some of the outlets picking up bits and pieces of it. Perhaps it's they think it's, you know, sort of image protection. Perhaps it's them doing their duty as the comm shop for the Democrat socialists to send the signal to Joe that, it's over after 22 or it's over certainly by 24. And there's some scheme afoot to figure out what the line of succession is beyond Biden-Harris. It's not exactly clear. Maybe it's a combination of the above. But I still think the more pressing question for the Republic is you see it, you understand what it is. It is really not very much in doubt. Do you care? Or are we just going to apply this lowest common denominator standard to all politicians and expect that they will rape and pillage the country best they can for their personal enrichment while they're in office? And we're just going to say, well, this is how it works in 21st century America, which is sort of a bit more civilized and sophisticated kleptocracy. You expect leaders to enrich themselves in these third world autocracies, and I guess we expect leaders in this country to do it today as well. Is that where you want your expectations to lay? That's the more interesting question that somebody inside the Beltway or some buddies, including the Republican Party, should be asking, and also holding themselves to the standard of the answer to that question, whatever it may be. Hopefully it's not the Mitch McConnell answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Before we get to the main feature of this latest installment of Sports and Politics, I did want to note Tiger Woods' return to the Masters today.
Oh, yeah, 10:34 tee time, your time.
And it's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine who put some money down on Woods.
Oh, boy.
Would that be
your bookie you talked to, Dan?
The over-under on his score today, 74.5.
Really?
Would you take the over or the under?
I'd take the over.
So would I. He's three over and you're in the money. I mean, I got a friend who's down there, and he was saying yesterday at the practice round, the way he walks around, it's like his leg below the knee is prosthetic. And even he was saying in an interview earlier this week, when he was still sort of game time decisioning it, said, you know, the biggest thing for him, the biggest challenge is not going to be his swing, but walking the course and the inclines on that course.
I heard those are brutal. I mean, even for people who are in shape, that it's hard with the inclines.
So it's going to be really interesting. But to have that much time off and to be coming back with that from that injury with that challenge and at his age, too, this is not Ben Hogan in the prime of his career. I don't know, boy. I hate to bet against Tiger, but I'd have a hard time not seeing him shoot 75 plus.
Yeah.
So anyway.
But everybody will be watching. It's 9:34 a.m. our time, so that's good. At least, you know, bring people back to the sport of golf and get it, you know, it's exciting again.
All right. So we've talked a lot about women's sports lately because of the male invasion of women's sports. But this is a real big bet in women's sports. This is a bigger bet than I would make.
I can't wait to hear this story.
See if you think, agree with me, that this is the worst business idea in the history of the restaurant bar sector.
Okay.
Ready?
I'm ready. What is it?
It's a bar.
Yeah.
In Portland.
Of course.
Yeah, so fill in the blank.
Uh-oh.
Called The Sports Bra. It is a bar that shows only women's sports.
Home of the WNBA. Only women's sports.
Jenny.
Oh boy.
Nguyen wanted to change this problem they have in Portland, where that you can't find a bar that plays women's sports, only men's sports. So she's done a 180. Mission to make great food and delicious drinks, provide a space that supports, empowers, and promotes girls and women in sports and in the community. Yeah.
I mean, I'm all for women's sports. I play women's sports, coach it. But I don't think there's a real appetite or desire out there for a women's sports only bar. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Or you can text us. Text line's open. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
All right, here's a little test to see, you know, if you want a virtue signal, say this is a great idea, I would go to the sports bra and watch women's sports. First of all, no, you wouldn't. But I'll put this to the test. And Mike Scott cannot help with the answer to this question.
Oh, no. Oh, but he's chomping at the bit. Look at him. Oh.
He would go to the... Maybe if they franchise it, he could run the sports bra in Chicago.
Mike, would you be interested in running the sports bra in Chicago?
We can connect you with Portland. Who won, what team won the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship? It just happened this weekend.
Hold on.
I'm not done with the question.
And don't say who did they play.
Well, who did they play?
I know who won. I think I know who they play.
Who did they play? Name one player or coach on either team.
You know, now he had to ruin the game.
Well, you could do it for North Carolina, Kansas, couldn't you?
No. Bill Self is the coach. of Kansas.
You just did.
Former coach
Who's the coach of North Carolina, the men's coach? Come on now.
He played for North Carolina. He got spanked. I don't know. He was wearing a blue shirt.
Imagine him wearing a blue shirt. Yeah.
Back to your original question, please.
All right.
Thank you. I shall be respected here. The Gamecocks won. South Carolina Gamecocks won the women's NCAA tournament.
It's interesting
that won the NIT women's tournament? South Dakota Jackrabbits. Mm-hmm.
That's just because you have a personal connection to
South Dakota. Right, they beat UCLA.
It's interesting that you refer to South Carolina first by their nickname.
It's true.
It's an awesome nickname.
Who is the coach of South Carolina? Come on now.
A Gamecock.
Yes. A farm animal coaches the South Carolina women's team.
Does
Dawn
a heck of a
Staley.
Job. Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
Not to be confused with Deuce Staley, the great running back for the Eagles. So South Carolina, Amy, beat who in the women's championship?
Stanford?
Wrong.
Wrong color.
Who was it?
UConn.
UConn.
Oh, that's right.
Gina Auriemma.
They're in the championship every year.
Mike, I thought you weren't supposed to be a part of this conversation.
No, I'm just pointing out that you don't know.
Okay.
Yes. So this is my point. You're a coach. You're active in women's sports. You're a promoter of women's sports.
Yes.
You had a women's basketball championship that occurred just 4 days ago amid all the March Madness, and you could, barely remember who won. You don't know who they played. You can't name a player or coach on either team. And you're telling me, you know what, let's go take in SEC tournament, women's ACC tournament game over at the Sports Bra and get a burger. Who is going to say that?
Who's going to pick up chicks, too, at the Sports Bra?
Or chicks
going to be chicking up? Yeah.
I just don't think there's enough. Maybe in Portland, I don't know if there's enough lesbians across the country to support this concept. Randy and Sandwich on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Will the waitresses be in sports bras or no?
No, there's no indication. And Randy, we're talking about Portland. I'm not sure you really want to promote that idea with this ownership group and their disposition. Thanks for the call,
I wonder
Randy.
If you bring in a sports bra of your own and hang it on the wall, do you get a free drink? I mean, that might be a way to lure in some customers.
Well, again, I mean, it's all, who your customer base is.
Now I want to go. I think we should go on a field trip. Maybe we can do a live remote from the Sports Bra in Portland.
Kevin on the west side.
Yeah, as long as they play 24/7 women's beach volleyball, I'm all for it.
Yeah, that's, that's a good idea.
That is a pretty good idea. Yeah.
Very talented. Mm-hmm. And beautiful. And I'm jealous.
Jeff in Lincolnshire.
Good morning. You mentioned the burger a minute ago. It got me hungry. You didn't mean vegan burger, right?
Yeah, I assume that's the case in Portland.
Or a turkey burger.
I would just love what Portlandia would do with this. I'm actually surprised Portlandia, Fred Armisen and I forget the chick's name.
Amy Poehler. No, that's Parks and Rec.
No.
Sorry.
And Fred Armisen, the Portlandia show, what they would do to parody this, because they did such a great job parodying the women to women feminist bookstore on Portlandia. I would love to see what they do with the sports bra. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thanks for taking my call. Listen, I think you might have missed one little possibility here that this place will be take off like crazy and be a big success. They probably have the lineup on these TVs with their girls mud wrestling. They'll have the topless football games. The whole lineup of all this kind of stuff. That place will be jumping.
Well, if they thanks for the call, Craig. Yeah, it could go the way of Stripes, John Candy there, and Stripes have the mud wrestling, and it make it participatory. That could be interesting. I don't think unless you do beach volleyball, the lingerie football league, and maybe female WWE matches.
Well, there's cage matches or whatever you call that women partake in, which I think that's very unwomanlike.
You mean UFC?
UFC, yes, excuse me.
Yeah.
Have you watched those? It's just not...
No, I don't want to watch them.
I don't either.
Yeah.
Two chicks beating up on each other like that? Ugh.
Here's the kind of guy, though, that would potentially go to the sports bra. And again, maybe this bar owner knows her community better than, you know, we do here in the Midwest, because I think this is probably representative of a lot of the men who live in Portlandia, but also a lot of the men who live in Chicagoland. So it could make a go here.
Claire, I'm actually a feminist.
How?
I was feeling really bad, you know, like I don't do a whole lot. I'm kind of like a stay-at-home dad, but without a kid, so I'm like a stay-at-home guy. But I'm actually a feminist, because what's happening is I'm enabling you to be the breadwinner.
By what, not having a job?
I'm subverting the patriarchy.
I had personally never thought of it like that.
I used to think I was a wimp, but really, I'm a feminist.
That's very interesting, Doug.
Guess what? You like voting?
I do.
There was a time where women weren't allowed to vote.
I know.
Do you know the word Frida Kahlo?
Yeah, I've heard of the artist.
The word.
She was a female Picasso and probably got paid way less.
Okay, I'm going to go make dinner.
Claire.
What?
You're a woman.
Great.
You could do anything.
Do you want to help make dinner?
I don't know how equipped I am to do it. How about I take out the garbage at the end?
Did you shower today?
No.
Jack in Whiting, Indiana.
That's awesome.
Good morning. I think I'm going to open up a Hooters franchise right next door to that place.
Yeah, good luck getting the business permit in Portland for a Hooters. Thanks for the call, Jack. Jim in Crown Point.
As bad of an idea it is, I heard their customer base is mothers against drunk driving.
Okay.
It's so not funny.
Well,
I don't get it.
I'm struggling with that myself.
But the inside, if you see the decor, I mean, there's women's sports paraphernalia everywhere. Championship jerseys from games I never saw. A bat and glove from something game I never saw either. So it could be like a museum.
They have a
feminist museum and get drunk while you're looking at it all.
They've got a league of their own on a continuous loop. The Indigo Girls are playing opening night. Oh. Yeah, I got it.
Dan, it's your favorite.
The gist.
It's the food menu, farm to table.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Everything's farm to table. Everyone's vegans, vegetarian, gluten-free, dairy-free. They've got it all.
Do we have time for a serious note on women's sports? Because I don't want to be called a misogynist again. So I want to do something serious on women's sports, too. We have time for that? I think we do.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
All right. So, you know, set the sports bra aside, if you would.
Fine.
Riley Gaines. She is a swimmer for the University of Kentucky. And she competed against the clownfish, Leah Thomas, in the recently concluded NCAA championships. In the 200 meters, she actually tied him for fifth place.
Wow.
And she was on with Tucker Carlson to explain what happened then, what the NCAA did to her. And thankfully, as she describes, because she has the support of her coach and the university, she can say on behalf of a lot of female swimmers and female athletes what a lot of other female swimmers and female athletes don't feel they can say. Take a listen.
Me and Leah just recently tied at the NCAA championships. And honestly, I think the NCAA handled everything extremely poorly, starting from when we finished and I went behind the podium to collect my fifth place trophy. And, you know, they kind of blatantly told me that Leah would hold the fifth place trophy and that I could pose with the sixth place trophy for photos. And would be mailed a fifth place trophy in the mail. So,
what?
Kind of questioned it, you know. I asked him, is there a reason why you're giving Leah the trophy? He just explained to me that we're giving it in chronological order. And I questioned him again, you know, what does that mean? We tied. What are we being chronological about? And he kind of blatantly said, we're just going to give the trophy to Leah. We respect and admire your swim, but Leah needs to hold the trophy.
Leah needs to hold the trophy.
That's despicable.
First of all, why are they giving out fifth-place trophies? But I digress.
Well, it's a chance. I mean.
Secondly, Leah needs to hold the trophy. So, just more evidence of what we have said for eons. This is not about tolerance or acceptance. You must celebrate. You must capitulate. You must sacrifice yourself on the altar of our identitarian politics. So Riley Gaines finishes fifth with Leah Thomas. Leah Thomas has to hold the trophy because we have a political agenda here and you're not part of it.
Yeah, you're getting in the way. Stop, you know, kicking the hornet's nest.
Leah needs to hold the trophy.
That says it all, and I'm so glad she came forward on Tucker Carlson.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley sent a letter to Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas yesterday, pointing to reports that DHS is pulling Department of Veterans Affairs doctors to treat sick illegal immigrants at the border, and is also looking to provide migrants with free smartphones.
Why? To make sure they show up for their court hearings?
That's the argument. Before we even get to the phones, you're going to take VA docs away from their duty to care for veterans and send them to the border to prioritize people who have come into this country or attempting to come in this country illegally?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
That is a new low, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, just when you think it can't get any worse. It's just such a slap in the face for anyone who's served this country. That we're going to prioritize people who are coming here illegally from not just Mexico and not just Honduras and Nicaragua, from all over the world who want to come in. And we're going to take their health and safety over yours.
I'm all for, you know, caring for people who are ill at wherever you find them, whenever you can. But to displace resources for veterans who we have a legal and moral obligation to prioritize, that is beyond the pale. The letter from Holly. The Biden administration has announced it intends to rescind its Title 42 order, which will only exacerbate the crisis at the southern border. And everyone, by the way, starting with those local officials at the border, agrees with that. There's no plan to deal with the influx of illegal immigrants when Title 42 is rescinded. This is the COVID era protocol under Trump, where you could immediately expel anyone who tried to enter this country illegally because of the COVID concerns.
It's basically the remain in Mexico, you know.
Yes, it is. And it was interesting because back when Mayorkas was being grilled by Republican senators last year, one of these hearings, one of his defenses for the record level of illegal border crossings was, well, actually, those numbers are a bit inflated because under Title 42, you have recidivist illegal crossers. They get expelled and they come back. And so, you know, 1.7 million illegal border crossings at the time, it ultimately reached 2 million last fiscal year. That's belied in terms of the actual numbers of people. And so now we're going to put that to the test, it would seem, because Title 42 is going away and there doesn't seem to be anything in its place other than this sort of general lawlessness that allows for 2 million people to cross illegally, 600,000 to be lost in America, which is what happened last fiscal year. He writes, Holly in his letter, new reports and leaked documents suggest the Department of Homeland Security plans to divert resources from our veterans so it can provide free services to illegal immigrants. These reports demand answers. Jen Psaki was asked about this by who else?
Peter Ducey.
Yesterday at the presser, the tracing the protocols that DHS will be and Border Security will be using to keep track of those trying to enter the country illegally, including the issue of the free smartphones. This was that exchange.
First on immigration, our team in Texas is saying that you guys are starting to give smartphones to border crossers, hoping that they'll use the phones to check in or to be tracked. Which part of that is supposed to deter people from crossing illegally into the states?
Well, I think you of all people, since you've asked me a range of questions on this topic over time, would recognize that we need to take steps to ensure that we know where individuals are and we can track in, and we can check in with them. The Alternatives to Detention program is what we utilize as three unique forms of technology to monitor participants enrolled in the program. Telephonic, this is one of them, which uses a participant's voice to create a biometric voice print during the enrollment process. And when the participant has a check-in call, their voice is compared to the voice print. Smart Link, which is another option, enables participant monitoring via smartphone or tablet using facial matching technology to establish identity. And Global Positioning System monitoring is of a participant's location and movement history using satellite technology through an ankle bracelet. This is all part of our effort as individuals come into the United States and individuals who are entering, who will proceed to immigration proceedings to monitor and track where they are.
Are you persuaded? That sounds great.
They're really going to sign up for that.
So we're paying for smartphones to provide to illegal immigrants so that they can be monitored by our government to ensure they show up for their scheduled hearings.
Yeah, right.
And then there's also these other monitoring systems they have. It all very much sounds like the electronic monitoring program in Cook County.
Yeah, it sure does, doesn't it?
And the other thing, too, is, that's so interesting, Jen. You have all these systems in place, and it sounds great.
Who's going to monitor it?
Well, how about this? Could you explain to me how there were 2 million illegal border crossings last year and 600,000 people that were lost in America with these wonderful technological innovations you have to monitor people attempting to enter this country improperly? How did that happen? You've got all these systems in place. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Maybe there's something else afoot. Maybe it's a bit more purposeful than Jen Psaki is letting on. In Washington Examiner, Chad Wolf, former acting director of DHS under President Trump, writes, unlike past administrations, this White House looks at the border, doesn't see a crisis of illegal activity. It sees a capacity problem that needs solving. That's an important observation. We don't have a crisis there. We have to figure out how to accommodate those that are seeking entry by any means necessary. They're just concerned with how to move more illegal immigrants into the interior of the United States faster. Since taking office, Wolf writes, to provide some examples of to support his argument, the Biden administration has lavished tens of millions of dollars in grant money to nonprofit organizations to house migrants and find opportunities for employment. They've also committed millions in taxpayer dollars to provide legal representation for migrants challenging their removal from the United States. The newly released Biden budget for fiscal year 2023 commits $4.5 billion in legal defense for illegal immigrants over the next 10 years. Spending billions of taxpayer dollars on lawyers for illegal immigrants is a brazen slap in the face of people who can't fill up their own gas tanks because they're being squeezed by bad energy policies, inflation. He goes on to say Biden's recent budget included another hidden gem that undermines our border security. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is facing a $150 million budget cut and a 25% reduction in bed capacity to house migrants. Fewer beds means less space to house people as they're deported, forcing ICE to release those people into the interior of the country.
Right.
It's just a couple of examples to support this idea that they're not looking at a crisis. They're looking at a management challenge to accommodate the capacity demands of those coming to this country, attempting to come to this country illegally.
I love what Governor Abbott is going to do. He's going to get charter buses and bus them to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Like you hear
here's your problem. Because they have an influx, and people, they know that Title 42 order is coming to an end, so they're already on their way.
And can we remember something, too? Can we remember angel families?
Oh, yeah.
Can we, you know, put a human face on this so it's not just, you know, macro statistics about illegal crossings and people who've entered this country and taxpayer dollars? Can we remember people we spoke with on this show from Illinois who have had a family member killed by a person in this country illegally and have gotten no justice? Brian McCann in Chicago, who lost his brother Denny in a hit and run accident. Eric Brady in Mahomet down in central Illinois, who lost his wife Jeannie in a car crash that was the fault of a person in this country illegally who fled. Both of them fled,
and they still haven't been apprehended. Yep.
And Trump, to his credit, profiling these angel families during his time when he could to again put a human face on these disastrous policies. And this is not anti-legal immigration. It's not anti-immigration from any particular country. It's pro-rule of law. And to the extent that the left wants to try to put the "you're a racist if you disagree with me" facade over their open border policy, go ahead. Because they can't even sell their own party members in border states on that argument anymore. Kristen Sinema and Mark Kelly, the two Dem senators from Arizona, both opposing the rescinding of the Title 42 protocol, for example. Democrats and Republican local office holders in border towns in Texas both saying there is no plan and we fear the influx that is to come. So go ahead. You want to be unreasonable. You want to be disingenuous. You want to try to cover this reckless, lawless, open border policy. Go ahead. Try it.
I mean, it's so maddening, too.
They're not fooling anybody that is not a fellow traveler.
It's just maddening to see, you know, parts of the fence that are still on the ground that could have just been erected. And he walked away from that.
Well, this is and look, this is the point J.D. Vance, GOP Senate candidate in Ohio, made, too. Republicans had no problem fast-tracking $14 billion in aid to Ukraine to, you know, for weapons assistance and aid to fight the Russians. And that's fine. But they couldn't see themselves fit to move $4.5 billion for border funding back when President Trump was president and the first 2 years where they had control of both chambers. That's the failure. That's the problem. And hopefully some lessons have been learned, or if they are able to gain control of both legislative chambers again, it will be short lived.
Hey, back to those smartphones, though. Do they have to take a smartphone or can they opt out? Or they could get one and then dump it if they don't want to be tracked.
Well, of course.
They can, you know, like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll take that. Boom.
Well, that's exactly what Ducey put to Psaki. He's like, well, what's this? Oh, thanks for the smartphone. Yeah, this will help me stay in touch. And then they dump it. And she's like, well, do you have any evidence they're doing that? No, I don't have any evidence they're doing that.
But it's called common sense, woman.
Yeah, I'm asking if that's a concern. Right. I'm using, you know, logic. Do you see any potential pitfalls with this program?
I mean, if somebody on electronic monitoring in Chicago doesn't want to be, they can cut their bracelet off.
Tony and Steger.
You know, I don't even have a smartphone.
Well, why don't you try coming into this country illegally and you can get one?
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking if I go to Mexico, denounce my American citizenship, and then I come back over, I get all kinds of stuff. But you know what? Instead of the cell phone, let's put a little tracking device inside them. All right? Just like they do for dogs and cats and things like that. That would be good. They can't discard that.
Thanks for the call,
Tony.
Those
are chips, not tracking devices.
No, we don't want to microchip anybody.
But still, too, another point of contention, we still have to test negative to get back into this country as an American citizen, but yet no one's checking them. They can just come in and they don't have to take a, you know, test to stay policy down there for them.
It's
mind numbing.
I cannot get past dispatching VA doctors to the border.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have Doctors Without Borders. You have people volunteer the time. You've got clinics. Hey, again.
Tap into that.
Provide medical assistance to whoever needs medical assistance, even if they've tried to come to this country illegally. Right? Of course. But to take resources away from veterans for any amount of time, it's not like the VA hasn't had their own problems living up to the promises that are to be kept between the American people and those who have served our country. It's not like the VA has been pristine in its performance. And now you're suggesting that this is a wise use of those resources? It's incredible to me. It's incredible. Eric, Rolling Meadows.
Hey, good morning. Could you imagine if the last administration would have said this, that we want to track all the illegal immigrants? Could you imagine what the heads would be spinning? It's amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, we want to track everyone, know where you're at. I mean, it's just nuts.
Yeah, it was funny. Thanks for the caller. Psaki started to say track, and then she pulled back because, you know, this monitor, you know, stay in touch. You know, it's all very
We're going to send them text messages about why they should be Democrats.
Yeah, right.
Vote Democratic. Vote for
exactly.
this candidate.
Yeah, they need
smartphones. It's another line of communication. They can do it in Spanish, too.
Yeah. I'm
telling you, they're capable of very sinister things.
Steve in Hoffman Estates.
Yeah, hi, Dan and Amy. Thanks very much for what you guys do every day. As an Operation Enduring Freedom veteran, I listened to the clip from Psaki. She never answered Ducey's question. She just spewed on a scripted response, what seemed like 10 minutes. It was probably 20 seconds. And it never answered his question.
That's right. Thanks for the call, Steve. Because, you know, what's the answer? And what can she do other than stick to the talking points? Joe on 294.
Yes, good morning. I'm all for the VA doctors helping the illegal aliens. As long as they include the White House physicians, do the same. And let Joe and Jill Biden go on the Obamacare. And while they're at it, they can use Air Force One, Air Force Two, Marine One, Marine Two to shuttle the illegal aliens across the state lines, too, when the Joe and Kamala go on their junkets.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Dawn, Crystal Lake.
Good morning. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has a statement on their website. I think you can thank a large part of what is going on to the Catholic Church. And, Dan, I know you're Catholic. Mm-hmm. You're not going to appreciate what I have to say. But when you let Catholics into the country and you elect them to office, you will lose your country, and that's what's happening.
Well, thanks for the call, Dawn. I'm all for self-examination, but, you know, Catholics aren't monolithic. So I would say, yes, if you elect social justice Catholics, liberation theologians, or just general frauds who use Catholic as ornamentation, and they're just, you know, left-wing politicians. And that, by the way, includes, unfortunately, a lot of men of the cloth in the Catholic Church. Then I agree with you. But just like we don't say, you know, all Methodists are that or all
Episcopalians
are this. Yeah. I mean, it's not all Catholics. There's a real schism in the church. And frankly, there's a real schism in all the churches, as far as I can tell.
Oh, yeah.
Because everything has become so politicized. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Yes. Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Instead of sending the doctors from the VA hospital down there to evaluate the these illegals coming in, why don't they send Fauci and the doctors from the CDC down there and let them evaluate them?
All right. Thanks for the call, Rich. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. More life imitating dystopian art in the COVID era. This lockdown the Chinese communists have imposed on the residents of Shanghai.
I shake my head. I would never want to live like that.
Again, you mean?
Again, right.
Could happen.
Ugh.
So residents of Shanghai are like protesting from their balconies. They're going to their balconies, like we saw actually in Italy. First phase of the lockdowns in the Western world. Yeah, Italy, but going to their balconies to sing, to protest lack of supplies. And then a drone appears.
What happened?
That has a message for those on their balconies protesting. And it's in Chinese, so I'll just read what it says. The drone flying over the skies of, you know, these multifamily buildings in Shanghai, quote, "Please comply with COVID restrictions. Control your soul's desire for freedom. Do not open the window or sing."
Oh, I just got the chills. Those poor people.
You cannot out sci-fi reality.
Well, their whole thing is they with zero COVID policy, and that's their choice, and that is a bad choice to make. But we're going to feel the effects here because all the plants are shut down. I mean, it's what, 29 million people on lockdown? 26, excuse me.
For more on the continuing fallout from COVID and the continuing effort by state and local COVIDians to extend their power, Amy is right when she says it's not over. It's not over in terms of people getting sick, and that's something that we need to take notice of. But it's also not over in terms of politicians seeking to extend, if not continue to expand, their power over your lives. Phil Kirpin, president of American Commitment, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, joins us. Phil, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys, my pleasure. And let me just say, I'll give you two silver linings of this completely insane situation in China right now. Number one, if they had done this in the beginning, then, of course, we would have copied all of it. So be thankful that the drones and the singing band, that didn't happen in 2020, although, you know, because if it did, we definitely would have had it in D.C. and Chicago, and, you know, so that's good. But number two, you know, this massive, insane human rights crime in China does have a silver lining for American motorists. I hate to be crass, but they're destroying a lot of oil demand, and so that's helpful there at least.
My boy, you really have to dig to get to silver linings, understandably, when you're talking about these sort of totalitarian policies. Something else, though, too, as we're continuing to assess the fallout, and I know you have a report on the mask-mandated versus the unmask-mandated schools. CDC, in a survey of childhood mental health, reported recently that a third of U.S. high school students reported poor mental health during the pandemic. Nearly half, 44%, said they felt sad or hopeless, and a near 20% said they seriously considered suicide in the past 12 months. With the continued repercussions in terms of kids' mental stability from these policies over the last two plus years.
Yeah, we had a mental health crisis among young people in this country even before this hit. But what we've done to children has made it so much worse. It's like staggering. I think the last comparable number, it's not really comparable, but the last time they asked, you know, did you recently consider suicide? It was in the last 30 days. They changed the question in the last 12 months. So you can't totally compare, but it was like 10% and now it's 25 or something like that. And all of this was foreseeable. We knew this was going to happen. There's no surprise to it. And the really sick thing is that there's no benefit to show for it. And they never go back and check. Have you noticed that? They say masks will keep schools open. We know what we're doing. We know what works. And then, you know, they never go back a couple months later and check. Did it actually work? What happened? Did the mask places do better than the unmasked? And so that's why we did this study, was to, you know, find out, not a theory, not a model, but what actually happened this winter. Were there more closures and more COVID in the places that did not mask than in the places that did? And we actually found the opposite. There was significantly more school disruption in masked school districts than unmasked. In fact, about 35% of mask-mandated school districts had a disruption in January or February versus 11% in unmasked school districts. And if you look at it in terms of the percentage of student learning days disrupted, the disparity is even greater than that. It was four times the number of percentage of student days disrupted
in mask-mandated districts versus unmasked. And, you know, I don't think that it was masks that caused COVID to spread more or anything like that. But what masks do is they spread panic. They spread the emergency mentality that you need to be on edge. And when the cases come, as they inevitably do everywhere, in the mask places, they panicked and freaked out more, and they were more likely to close or go remote. And that's why they had a significantly higher rate of disruptions. And yet, you know, what did the CDC and the Federal Department of Education say over and over and over? They said you have to have masks to keep schools open. So, you know, we went back and checked what happened. They still haven't. But I think that when we get back into the fall and winter and they say all the exact same things again, which, of course, they will, we really need to hold their feet to the fire and say, no, this is, you know, how do you account for what actually occurred in January and February 2022? Because it was the exact opposite of what you said would happen.
And what school district, what part of the country did you take your samples from?
Well, we used data from Burbio that includes all 500 of the largest school districts in the country by enrollment. So it covers about 35 or 40% of all of the students in the country. It does not have the rural areas, so we don't know if those look different or what have you. But basically, it's all the large urban and suburban districts.
And so here's the thing, too, is you have to compare, like you're doing, going back and what happened, what were the results of the policies in this comparison, and then compare other outcomes, too. So you say these are the choices before you. And understand there is nothing that there's no choice that is without risk or without potential pain, at least for some. And here, so let's start with what we know to be true about the human condition. And this, of course, is always a challenge with the left because they think they can, you know, reinvent the human condition. But going back to the CDC study, the importance of connectedness among young people. In that CDC study about kids' mental health, teens who felt connected to both adults and their school buddies were far less likely to experience feelings of sadness or despair. By 35% connected, 53% not connected. Suicidal thoughts, 14% who felt connected had such thoughts versus 26% who didn't feel connected. On those who attempted suicide, 6% of those who felt connected made the attempt versus 12% of those who didn't feel connected. So that human connectedness to your teachers, your coaches, as well as your friends, I mean, that's something that in a sense you can measure, and the CDC has the data now.
Yeah, look, I mean, we've got a lot of evidence now that policies, policy interventions, mask mandate, school closure, whatever you want to try to do, doesn't seem to make any difference at all for COVID. Any difference, it relies on some extremely complex mathematical model. When we look at what actually occurs, we see no difference, or even the intervention places do worse in terms of COVID. So there's no upside, or the upside is infinitesimal to these interventions. But we know, without question, we really knew it at the front end, but now, unfortunately, we have all of this empirical proof that disrupting children's lives has profound negative consequences for them, both educationally and in terms of their mental health. And so I just, you know, you have these people who just, they want to say, abundance of caution, you can't be too careful. And in fact, what they're doing is abundantly reckless, not cautious, because they are knowingly causing harm to children on the theory that it may produce some speculative benefit that's too small to even detect when we look at actual data. And so I think, you know, I'm not even sure there is a trade-off, because I don't really see any benefit to these COVID policies. But if you want to give, you know, I want to say, okay, there's some benefit. It's so tiny, it's hard to determine. We actually see the opposite in the empirical data. But you look at the downside, and it's everything you just named on mental health. It's massive losses in educational attainment. We are harming children in a really profound way. And, you know, the administrators who made these decisions, the people who pushed for these decisions, the politicians, they've got to be held responsible, because they chose to do this.
It's more in Chicago, it's more the unions.
Everywhere, to the extent they have power. I mean, union power was the best predictor of school disruption, of any of the factors that I've seen. And so that's a huge, huge problem. But, you know, we can't let them avoid admitting they were wrong
by doing this every year. Well, okay?
Phil, well, no, Phil, I don't mean to interrupt, but we're kind of up against the clock. But this morning, 952 perfectly healthy children in Chicago public schools cannot go to school and have to stay inside their homes because they were around, because they're not vaccinated and they were around somebody who might have COVID or does have COVID. And where else in America are they doing this besides Chicago public schools?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of places where there's a lot of union power, so a lot of the bluest cities still have crazy policies like that. But I thought that school quarantines were struck down in court in Illinois. Is that
no,
not the case?
Just for people that were named on the lawsuit.
Well, here,
so the union wants a way around it. That's
else,
why.
Shouldn't anyone else bring their own lawsuit if they're subject to the same illegal order?
So here's the larger point, though, which and John Murawski has a good piece of Real Clear Investigations on it as well, that, you know, this isn't over as far as a lot of politicians are concerned. And even those that have relaxed some of the restrictions don't believe for a second if they didn't see an opportunity to reimpose them that they wouldn't. And frankly, in Illinois, Jelly Belly Pritzker and Triple Threat have said as much in their announcement of the relaxation. Murawski, 12 states, 7 of them with a Democrat governor and legislature, have emergency orders still in place. The remaining states have either ended their emergency or have announced a date to terminate it. But, a dozen states are still operating under an emergency order and will, in many of those states, will through the rest of this year. So, again, the vigilance required with respect to what particularly COVIDian-oriented politicians are doing or want to do extends as well.
Yeah, look, it's never over until the people in power either admit they were wrong or are replaced by other people. Because as long as the people in power are still in power and have not admitted they're wrong, it's going to come back every time. You know, it's going to come back in winter. It's a seasonal respiratory virus. So, you know, that's unfortunately what we have to look forward to again unless we can force these people to admit they were wrong or replace them at the ballot box.
He is Phil Kirpin, president of the American Commitment, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition as well. Phil, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
All right, have a good one.
Thanks, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You know, people are talking about this Hannity interview of Sean Penn.
Oh, my God. It went on for 24 minutes. It was a love fest. I watched the whole thing.
Yeah, that's mostly wasted time. I don't know what's so interesting or why anybody would indulge Sean Penn's moralizing, Hugo Chavez enthusiast that he is. But he did offer one response to a Hannity comment that was actually quite enjoyable. I think Chicago residents will appreciate it. Hannity was going on about how he doesn't want to see, like everybody, every decent person, he doesn't want to see more images of dead bodies and dead children on the streets of Ukraine. And this was Penn's reaction.
I don't want to see one more dead kid in a street, one more innocent woman or man dead. I don't want to see any more images in my lifetime of mass graves like we're seeing.
Yeah, there or in Chicago, for that matter.
Anywhere.
Ooh. Sean Penn comparing Ukraine to Chicago.
Uh-oh.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, as we talked a little bit earlier in the show, when we talked about Riley Gaines, this Kentucky swimmer who tied Leah Thomas in the NCAA championships in her 200-meter event, tied for fifth place, only to be told that Leah gets to hold the fifth place trophy for the purposes of pictures and so forth because, you know, because Leah needs to hold the trophy.
That's what he said. Why? Well, she needs to hold the trophy.
Uh-huh.
Can you imagine? You've worked your whole life. You get to the NCAA championship swim meet. You tie for fifth, and you're the one who has to go home with the, you know, that a boy, good job, and we'll send you something in the mail.
And this is more prima facie evidence that this is not about tolerance. It's not even about acceptance. It's about promotion and enforcing that orthodoxy. You shall celebrate. And it also underscores this paradox of the feminist left must wrestle with, and how they're coming down with on this issue. Delino Squire, I mean, this is not a novel observation, but I thought it was a good riff. Andrew Sullivan has made the point. I've made the point. Delino Squires, who is a contributor to Jason Whitlock's Fearless podcast, was on with Tucker the other day, and he offered this riff on the topic.
So yes. For women like Joy Reid or you know, Rachel Maddow or Jemele Hill, so again, whether they work at ESPN or MSNBC, they finally found a group of men that they're willing to submit to, because when Rachel Levine speaks and when Leah Thomas speaks, these women feel that they have to be silent. So, in effect, they are about to diversity, inclusion, and equity themselves right out of existence. I think they know it, because one of the things that you'll see, right, you may have, like Congressman Cori Bush talk about birthing persons, right?
Right.
But then when they start to talk about abortion, they'll tell men to shut up because this is a woman's issue. So every once in a while, an issue will come up that'll knock them right back into reality. But really what they're doing, they're robbing young girls of opportunities in sports, in culture, in politics. And they are completely undermining the message that they've been giving for the last six decades. They've been telling girls, speak up for yourself, don't be afraid. And in many respects, Tucker, they've gone from I am woman, hear me roar, to singing, this is a man's world.
Well, we'll see who speaks up about this. Palm Springs, California. Palm Springs, California is launching a pilot program to guarantee $900 a month for trans or non-binary residents of Palm Springs because they are trans or non-binary. That's
it. Regardless of income. You could be a millionaire or you could be homeless on the street. If you're trans or non-binary, you get $900 a month.
20 trans and non-binary Palm Springs residents will receive the free money funded by taxpayers for 18 months. It will be the program will be managed by a trans leftist advocacy health center and local LGBTQIA plus advocacy group. Of course it will.
And the Palm Spring mayor is a Democrat who is transgender.
Of course. $900 a month because you're trans, universal basic income. Why? Because this is an oppressed group.
Well, she says, you know, this is why the mayor is doing it. She says the trans Americans suffer extremely high rates of under unemployment.
Underemployment.
Mm-hmm. And they have enormous challenges living full and authentic lives.
For more on this, Wesley Smith joins us, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How are you?
Can't be surprised by the UBI gambit in Palm Springs, California anymore, can we?
No, you know, this kind of demonstrates that we're in a moral panic. And this is not about science. It's not actually about protecting people with gender dysphoria or transgender people. It's about imposing cultural imperialism. And the things you mentioned are disturbing enough, but what really has me in a terrible condition of anxiety is for children, because the Biden administration is now set to force doctors to participate in gender transitions for adolescents and children, and that includes giving puberty blockers, hormones, and even the surgeries such as mastectomies for let's say 13 or 14 year olds, and genital changes, whatever you want to call it. And I just saw yesterday, in fact, I posted on the corner at National Review, that France's National Academy of Medicine came out with a study in which they're saying, wait a minute, slow down on this stuff. And they, and part of their advice, the France National Academy of Medicine said there's no reliable test to distinguish between persisting gender dysphoria and transient adolescent dysphoria. Now, France is not the Bible Belt. And what what these people in France are saying, and they're not alone, Sweden has gone, is putting on the brakes. The United Kingdom is putting on the brakes. Finland is now saying no puberty blockers because this will harm children. And often people, children who feel that they're the other sex, don't feel that way once they're through adolescence. And yet yesterday in testimony, the secretary of HHS, Becerra, said he wants the government to pay for this for children. And my sources tell me there's soon to be a rule published by HHS to say this must be covered by insurance. Doctors must do this. Hospitals must allow it, even if they're Catholic hospitals, and no religious exemption permitted.
But what happened to waiting for 1 year? I mean, you used to have to go to counseling for an entire year before they would, you know, before they would cut into anybody.
Well, the French pointed out that what is needed here is not a rush to treat in the sense of puberty blockers and surgeries and so forth, but a great deal of psychological and psychiatric intervention, which is how it used to be done. But today, as you were just discussing, someone can say, oh, today I'm a man, and the next day he can come out and say, the true me is a woman, and everyone's supposed to shift immediately. There was an interesting 60 Minutes of all places story several months ago about this whole transgender issue, and they had young people on, young adults, yeah, who had transitioned during teenagehood and had changed their minds, and they were saying, where were the adults protecting us?
Right.
And that's precisely the point. The adults in government today are pushing these agendas, and it's going to hurt children, at least many of them, and not help them.
Well, so and I remember that 60 Minutes piece. We discussed it. There was also a doctor on who was pro-trans, you know, completely left, but at least was professional enough, had enough integrity to recognize the adverse outcomes for some of these kids and pump the brakes, as you're saying. But what happened? I mean, we keep talking about this. What happened to the medical community? What happened to, I mean, we talk about it mostly in the context of COVID. But, I mean, are these doctors, were they just bought off by government grants or sinecures at research universities? And now they're horrified by the compromises they made, because Johns Hopkins was doing these gender reassignment surgeries and then they stopped and then they restarted under political pressure. So they knew this all along. This is nothing new, but they've gone along for so long, so far down this road. There has to be an explanation.
I think it's also ideology. If you read the New England Journal of Medicine and some of the other, the Lancet and other medical journals, bioethics journals, you know, at the highest level of academic discourse, they've gone completely woke. And, you know, they act as if, and as just as the government is, that there is no dispute over what is the proper approach to children that have this. There's also a lot of, I wouldn't call it proselytizing necessarily, but it is a moral panic. And where very, very few young people used to make this claim, the French report that I discussed earlier said it's almost like an epidemic. In fact, they used that term, epidemic. So it's not only the medical establishment that is pushing this and the federal government, but you see it in the social networks, and you see it in television, and you see all of the cultural elites basically embracing this and saying, well, this has to be your problem. Did you know that a couple of years ago in England, there was a scandal because they found out that teachers were persuading autistic children who can't defend themselves that their real problem is that they are transgender.
Oh, that's criminal.
So there's something going on here in the schools as well. It's very, very, we're in a very serious moment, and you don't have a federal government willing to step back and say, well, let's really look at this dispassionately. Instead, as you pointed out, the ideological purveyors of this this movement have been given tremendous power in this society, and they're a juggernaut at the moment.
And it's a moneymaker. I mean, I'm looking at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago right now. Gender identity and sex development. There's two arms, one arm where they provide counseling, another one where you can meet physicians, endocrinologists, social workers, surgeons, and nurses who have expertise in gender identity development.
And the parents will be kept in the dark often. And do you know who's making a lot of money off of this? Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
Oh, how's that?
I've been reading stories. They are producing these hormones. They are not producing them, but they're prescribing them and giving them to people.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose
of course
it's
they
like,
are. Why would that be surprising?
I suppose it's like the abortionists. You know, you don't think about the outcomes. You dehumanize your patient, and this is how you can get. I mean, it's one thing to do like ideologically on like race issues and financial matters, and you know, making somebody a ward of the state, but they're getting money, and so I feel good about transfer payments to people. It's another thing when you're participating in the mutilation of a child.
This is mutilation.
And that's what they're doing. But I suppose, I don't know, the only comparison I can come up with is the abortionist that just looks at their patient as a mass of protoplasm and doesn't care about outcomes.
And there are certain states that want to keep people in the dark. For example, on abortion, California does not require parental notification if a minor child gets an abortion. But what's really odd, I used to live there. I don't live there now, but I escaped. But there were two ballot initiatives to require not even parental permission, but parental notification, and those were rejected. So people in California don't want to be told when their daughters are getting abortions.
Well, right, yeah, right. I mean, so right, the level of indoctrination.
We're on the same road here on transgender issues because parents are being kept in the dark. And sometimes when parents object, they're being reported to social services. And I've even seen a few court cases where parents lost their like visitation rights and so forth because they refused to acknowledge the transition.
Yeah, one in Canada during a divorce.
Canada,
Well, I mean, it's something, too. We were talking about this the other day where you have sort of a velvet civil war going on and you're just having people organize by political philosophy throughout the country. So you were talking about abortion. So as California and Colorado are moving right now, abortion on demand, basically legalizing infanticide in contravention of federal law, I would argue. You have Oklahoma going the other way and other states going the other way. It just seems like we're going to move as is required to be with like-minded individuals. And you're going to have increasingly two groups of states that are just diametrically opposed in terms of their culture and community.
Yeah, it seems that way to me, too. You have California has a bill that would apparently allow, at least as to neglect after birth, no criminal consequence, because they're trying to prevent women from if they've, let's say, been a drug abuser and it results in a stillbirth. They're saying they're trying to prevent these women from being criminally charged. But the way the law is worded, I wrote about this, too. It would indicate actions or omissions after the birth of the baby, which could be opening the door to at least allowing an infant to be neglected to death. Remember when the ex-Virginia Governor Ralph Northam said that if a baby survived an abortion, that the baby would be kept comfortable and then there would be a conversation about what to do, meaning whether we neglect that child?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's now becoming the law in some states. And or at least there are proposals for that. And it's almost to the place, as you said, where this ideology is so intense that I think certain common decencies are being ignored because we want to own the other side. You have some states that are saying, you know, you cannot have biological males competing against women in sports, which makes sense because of the physical body issues. It's not a statement of morality. It's a statement of fairness for women who have worked so hard to achieve in sports, get scholarships, this kind of thing. Then you have other states who say, well, if you pass a law like that, we won't let any of our state representatives even go to your state. It really is an intense division based on these very controversial and provocative moral issues.
He is Wesley Smith, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, but I think the main thing we should all agree on is protecting children.
Yep. Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I don't know why Hollywood has decided to revisit the 1980s Showtime Lakers, but they have. You've got this series on HBO called Winning Time. Interesting cast. I haven't watched it yet, but Adrian Brody as Pat Riley.
Really?
What do you think about that choice? Huh. Maybe. John C. Reilly as Lakers owner Jerry Buss.
That's cool. That's good.
Yeah, I could see that. In addition to that, you have over on Apple TV this docuseries on Magic Johnson that is airing a little bit later this month. And that was the occasion for Magic Johnson to offer some commentary on, you know, the life and times of Magic Johnson and some of the issues that are covered in that docuseries, including his short-lived late-night talk show, The Magic Hour. Do you remember that? It's okay if you don't.
Oh,
it didn't last very long.
Wasn't that on CBS?
No. I think that
I can't remember.
I don't remember.
But I remember it and thinking.
Lasted
oh.
for like 5 minutes.
Yeah. And Arsenio Hall lasted a little bit longer.
Well, and so, I mean, literally, the Magic Hour lasted just months. And when the ratings were flagging, they decided to bring in Howard Stern, who was still, I guess, at the top of his game, whatever that means. Back in 1998, and essentially have like Howard Stern and Magic go back and forth for most of the show. And Magic talks about that now because some of Howard Stern's comments didn't particularly age well, especially against the backdrop of what American culture is 24 years later. So this was some of the back and forth that Magic now says. As he sat through it, he didn't want Howard Stern booked, but, you know, what are you going to do when your ratings are bad? And that's what the producers say.
You do what the producers tell you to do.
And secondly, he wanted to hit Howard Stern at some point. He goes on to say about some of the comments that you'll hear that he would never, he said... Let me quote him here. I was mad when they booked him, but there's nothing you can do when people look for ratings. This is what happens. He said, it is what it is. I learned a lot from that. I never put myself or HIV or AIDS or my race in that position again, ever again. And this is what he's referring to.
Man's getting out here trying to talk like the white man. Listen, you're a black man. I grew up in the black neighborhood. I'm blacker than you are. Trust me. I'm the blackest black man you'll ever meet.
Okay.
And I'm telling you right now, when I lived in Roosevelt, Long Island, which is a black ghetto, mm-hmm. everybody, Eddie Murphy comes from there. Everybody talk like this. This is the way I talk when I'm... I was a big marble mouth. But you know what? It was fascinating because I was one of the people. And I believe you should go to that. I know you want to go to that.
Well, you know what?
Why does everybody have to understand every word you say? Who cares what you got to say?
Understand.
Oh, it's so degrading and disgusting.
And this on Magic's health status. Of course, this was after it was known that he had HIV.
So you would have sex with everybody. At least you had fun getting AIDS. You know what I'm saying? I know guys, they go for a blood transfusion.
You
it's a real
bad.
Pain in the ass. You know what
bad.
I mean?
You are
I should
bad.
Only have some fun.
I never really understood the appeal of Howard Stern. I know he asked provocative questions, and so he was supposedly this great interviewer because he would put people on the spot and so on and so forth. But there's always going to be an audience for, you know, the juvenile and the crude. And there was no modulation. It was almost all juvenile and crude all the time with Stern. But, of course, that was very popular for a long time. So that was Howard Stern back then. Should Howard Stern be held to account for who he was back then, the things he said back then. Should Howard Stern be in the cancel culture's crosshairs? We just went through this with Joe Rogan from previous, you know, stand-up comedy routines, and we've gone through this with a bunch of people, tweets from a decade ago and so on and so forth. Should Howard Stern be exempt from such review? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Why hasn't he been canceled because of those comments?
Maybe because of what he's evolved or devolved into, depending on your perspective. A little bit more of Howard Stern in the 90s. Remember the infamous Ted Danson roast of Whoopi Goldberg?
Yes.
At the Friars Club, where Danson showed up in blackface?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Howard Stern did a parody of that with Sherman Hemsley, George Jefferson, back in the day. So shortly after that, that would have been like early to mid-90s.
Didn't you tweet this out? I saw this. Somehow.
Yeah, take a listen.
Oh, hush up. I hate blackface. I just can't get this off. Besides, Whoopi done wrote everything I'm going to say here tonight, so it's all right. Ain't that right, you smelly?
I didn't write that.
Wow. Well, you is a smelly. I got some more jokes for your New Year's Eve party there.
You're not tired of this.
And don't be racially offended, because Whoopi done wrote them for me, okay?
Here go we ahead. Go.
Black hole.
Black hole.
You're going to love this. Hello there. What do I loves most about the Whoopi?
Oh,
yes.
Man. Such a great timing.
Hey, Robin, what does you call a black rocket scientist?
I don't know, Ted.
Whoopi wrote it, Whoopi wrote it. Hey, did you happen to notice this?
No, what
this
is that?
This here's my mother, Mama Danson. Why, she done work in blackface, too.
She must be very proud.
Yeah.
Now, I know you really love me, Ted. You the man.
I tell you, you know, you the man. What done happened to Sherman's career? It's really off at the end. I want you to give us a kiss, you smelly head coon. I love you.
May I say something here?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you can say whatever you want, you smelly. Whoopi wrote that.
That's it, Ted. You didn't know I was going to say that. Whoopi had no chance to write it. I don't accept that kind of language. You can call her whatever you want, but you don't talk to me that way or I'll leave.
Well, don't let the door hit you on your big black ass, Mama, on the way out of here. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. Now, Whoopi, you is a filthy...
I didn't...
That's Howard Stern's comedic genius. Robin Quivers, towards the end, didn't like it as much, but of course, she's stuck with him to present, hasn't she?
Selling her soul to the devil.
What about that? What about that? I mean, I'm, you know, all for the Don Rickles and the Jackie Masons of the world, but Howard Stern's conduct over the years, in retrospect, even at the time, even with the participation, and this is where it's difficult to... you know, to rally to Magic's defense because, well, you were sitting there. You chose to be a part of these routines, whether it's Magic or whether it's George Jefferson there, Sherman Hemsley. What about Howard Stern on black role models? More classic Stern from the 90s.
And that's he really is the role model for how all black people should behave.
Well, you know, once again, I must say that not all people can be a comedian.
Yes, that is true.
You know, I think that we should look in other places besides show business.
But I'm talking
for
about
role model.
Don't behave as the comedian Sinbad. Behave as the guy on The Different World.
I see.
Yeah, that guy.
The coach guy.
The coach. You can be a coach, certainly. Not everyone can be a comedian, but everyone can be a coach.
True.
There's certainly enough teams around to coach. No, really, he is an excellent role model. Better than Arsenio. If you're going to have a role model, you go with Sinbad or maybe not even Luther Vandross. Go with, Gee, Sinbad is so excellent, it's hard to think of another one.
Yeah, it's hard to find somebody as good as Sinbad.
Yeah.
Not only that, he's married with children. You know, right. The whole thing, the whole package is there.
You know who else was kind of neat? Stymie on Little Rascals.
Oh, I don't know anything about
that. Very nice kid. Go back and watch it.
I don't know.
Go back and watch it.
I didn't watch too many of those shows.
Was a very nice kid. Buckley was a little hostile, but Simon. Watch
Buckley
Simon.
Was a rebel.
I mean, Buckley was okay, but if you want a role model, Stymie or Sinbad. I'm telling you. I'm telling you. And I'm saying it straight from the heart. If you want to succeed, don't emulate Spike Lee or this Mike Tyson. You're not going to be a professional boxer, believe me. You know who are pretty good guys, too, if you need a role model? The Pips. Remember Gladys Knight and the Pips?
That's right,
the Pips. The Pips are really good guys.
Just stayed back there dancing.
And yeah, but we're very well-behaved, even when Gladys Knight would do TV appearances.
What in God's name is going on?
More comedy classics from Howard Stern. What do you think? And how has Howard Stern been insulated from this performance review that so many other celebrities have been subjected to? Well, maybe because the new and improved Howard Stern over on Sirius became a toady for the left, pumping Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Oh, yeah.
Continuing to play that game right up until the president. Here's Howard Stern reacting to the Will Smith slap of Chris Rock at the Oscars the other week.
Because where's security? This is a live television event. Not one person came out because he's Will Smith. This is how Trump gets away with Will Smith and Trump are the same guy. He decided he's going to take matters into his own hands.
Trump's not violent.
You know, at a time when the world is at war, bad timing, man. I mean, just, you know, calm your f***ing ass down.
It shows where we are as human beings. Like, yeah. You can't even say something in a room without a war breaking out.
Yeah, so if you shoehorn Trump into a conversation about bad behavior, then you're exempt for your bad behavior, past or present, I guess. I don't know. I know that there are a lot of people that are Stern fans or were Stern fans, including who count themselves among conservatives. And I don't know, I felt this was a good opportunity since Magic is talking about the episode with Stern. To bring Stern's wonderful comedy to the fore and maybe, I don't know, maybe rethink what a fainter. I mean, I never listened to Stern. And then when he had that show on E, I mean, it's just all like, you know, cheap grade school sexual innuendo with strippers and Pamela Anderson and so forth all the time.
Sex sells, and he took advantage of it.
He's a fifth grader.
Yeah.
And you want to know why we have such a juvenile culture, such a harsh culture, a culture that's been degraded, sort of tracking along with the rise of people like Howard Stern. It's not alone, but including him. Well, that's why. I mean, it's, you know, this is not about, I'm not saying Stern should be silenced or canceled or anything of the sort. I'm just talking about what people's predilections are and why you would, Howard said this. You know, how many times do you hear people, oh, somebody said this. Yeah, you're substituting somebody else's thinking or behavior for their own. I mean, I get, again, the sort of appeal to prurient interest and the appeal to being provocative, even shocking. How about being, I don't know, insightful or witty or talented? I don't know. Just because you make a lot of money in this business or any other business doesn't mean you're particularly talented. It means maybe you seized upon a market opportunity. You know, there's people who make a lot of money with strip joints and adult bookstores. Does that mean they're geniuses? They have some great skill set? Or they just sort of understand the dark side of humanity and they appeal to that for financial gain? Mark in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm an ex-Stern listener. And, yeah, the reason I listened to him because I was a child, I said, yes, he was raunchy. And I believe the reason this man is not being canceled because he was instrumental in advancing the LGBT agenda, especially the L's and the B's, because he would always have hot lesbians on there, and he normalized lesbian behavior. You know, it's And you know, what once you normalize that, normalize the lesbians, how far is normalizing the gays right afterwards? And also, he's very pro-abortion, and Stern just loves to skewer traditional norms. And isn't that what the left is all about, destroying traditional norms? And Howard Stern is one of their top warriors at, you know, advancing perversion, destroying the decency, making fun of what is traditional and normal. And that's why he's not being canceled.
All right, Mark. Ralph Rantoul.
Hey, good morning. I was never a Stern fan, but yeah, he's always been a leftist, and he was very successful and still is in selling vulgarity and profanity and crudeness and appealing to base interests. I think that what he's done his whole career is dial it in to humanity's most prurient interests. He's not going to get canceled. He's got enough money now that he could walk away and it would never, you know, hurt him.
Oh, no question. No question.
Yeah, so he's not afraid of any of that. But
isn't he though? Isn't he afraid of it, though? Because why change his tune and be such a pedestrian, conventional leftist when it comes to talking about a presidential race or COVID? He was a huge COVIDian, or things like, you know, having to, as I said, shoehorn Trump into the conversation about Will Smith slapping Chris Rock. That is so boring and conventional.
Insecure.
What's that?
Yeah, he's weak and insecure. He's always been weak and insecure. He's a weird mix of, a smart guy who just deals in the worst elements of what he thinks is humorous, but he's a weak, insincere, lefty. And so he wants to be loved.
Exactly.
I don't even think it's about the money.
No, it's not.
No.
Exactly right. He needs to be relevant. He needs attention.
He needs the ego fed on a daily basis.
He's a man without a chest. And we talk about it all the time. Man without a chest. And you know what the other thing is? What? From my limited exposure to Howard Stern over the years, including looking back at some of these clips, he's not funny. Howard Stern's so talented. Why? Because he built a big audience based on appealing to the lowest common denominator, and then celebrities went and played bit parts in his circus for their own, you know, notoriety, for their own career advancement, because they are also men and women without chests, and somehow that translates into Howard Stern being so, legendarily talented. Hardly. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, I can't remember when you were at WLS. Was it owned by Cumulus at that point, or was it still Citadel?
No, it was Cumulus.
You labored under the Cumulus.
Yeah, I think I went when I was there with Citadel. Then it was bought by Cumulus. Yes,
right. And so I was there
for Cumulus, right?
Cumulus. I mean, for the transition, but then for a few years under the wonderful stewardship of the Dickey brothers, such great operators. They literally thought, I know this from being on the inside,
yes,
so I'll share this.
What?
Remember when Cumulus put Mike Huckabee on as a nationally syndicated show?
Uh-huh.
They wanted to dump Rush Limbaugh, and they thought they did. They didn't want to re-sign him at the time, and they thought Mike Huckabee could replace Rush Limbaugh.
Wow.
You know, when I was there, we had a great program director in Drew Hayes, who's now in L.A. He was awesome. And there were some great people there. For our former general sales manager then came over to 560. Michael Mann was there. So some really good people. But it was a terrible operator, Cumulus Media. And apparently not much has changed, both at WLS and system-wide. To that point, the Amber Athey story, we've had Amber on several times before. She's Washington editor for The Spectator. She's a senior Blankley fellow at the Steamboat Institute. And she was on the Cumulus station in D.C., part of the Larry O'Connor show. And then she wasn't. What happened? Amber joins us now. Thanks for joining us, Amber. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So you made a tweet about Vice President Kamala Harris's brown pantsuit that she donned for the State of the Union address. What was that tweet, and what was the fallout?
The tweet was, Kamala looks like a UPS employee. What can brown do for you? Nothing good, apparently. Huge mistake, apparently. You're not allowed to criticize the Empress's new clothes. A couple of days after that tweet went out, I ended up getting involved in a Twitter spat about like transgender children, so totally separate issue. But the people involved in the debate were really upset that I didn't think we should chemically castrate kids, so they thought they had to cancel me. They went back into my Twitter account and various other things and started posting the screenshot of this Kamala tweet and claiming that it was racist. They said that the "What can brown do for you" comment was obviously about Kamala's skin color and not about the pantsuit. So they sent a bunch of emails to both The Spectator and Cumulus. And unfortunately, Cumulus decided that the smart or easy thing to do was to just go ahead and fire me.
Everybody knows what brown can do for you. That's the slogan of UPS, obviously. But are you going to fight back? Have you hired an attorney?
So I've looked into some legal options. This happened a month ago. The reason that I waited so long to go public was I was talking to some lawyers. Unfortunately, Cumulus has this social media policy that is so vague as to cover pretty much anything. So the only portion of the policy that I could see that I violated by their standards was you basically can't do anything on or off the air that makes the company look bad. So, of course, if they are looking for a reason to get rid of you, or someone supplies them ammo with a reason to get rid of you, then they can just put it under this policy, and there's pretty much no recourse. So we've been working internally as well for the past month, myself and the other hosts on WMAL, and eventually we just exhausted all of our options.
Right. And so, I mean, and the context here, too, you tweet this out and it's about her brown pantsuit. And there were other people, of course, live tweeting during the State of the Union, making comments about clothes and facial expressions and everything else, Kamala's and everybody else's. And that was the context in which you added to the ridicule, right?
That's exactly right. It was sent during the State of the Union. If you look at the timestamp on the tweet, I believe it was the night of March 1st. Around maybe 8 or 9 p.m. And what's funny about the situation is that was actually the tamer version of the tweet. I was sitting at trivia with a bunch of friends, and I was like, oh, man, Kamala looks terrible. I should tweet something about this. Everybody's ridiculing her outfit. And I think the initial tweet was something like maybe she looks like a poop emoji. Thank God I didn't send that one in retrospect. We actually pared it down to the UPS tweet, and apparently that was still too far for the left.
And some users compared her to a Hershey's chocolate bar.
Right, yeah. I mean, the people commenting on Kamala's pantsuit were pretty unending. There was actually a segment about it on Saturday Night Live during the weekend update. So it's not like I was doing anything that was unheard of or that was particularly cool or anything like that. I thought my tweet was actually pretty tame in comparison to a lot of the other memes that were being made. But again, like, this wasn't an honest campaign. This was something that happened because these people were upset about something else I said politically, and they were trying to shoehorn anything that I had said into the umbrella of racism so that they could try to get me in trouble and shut me up.
And so what did Cumulus say to you? How did that interaction go after this tweet came to light and they whistled you in?
It actually took a week from the time that, as I understand it, they started getting emails to when they fired me, which is also really strange because the attention had pretty much died down after a day or two. But then, you know, a week later, I get off the air on a Wednesday morning, and a few hours later, I get a phone call from two Cumulus executives And they tell me that they had been made aware of this tweet, that they had determined that it was racist and that it had violated their social media policy. And they were terminating me effective immediately. And the last communication that I would have was to receive a copy of my last pay stub. And otherwise, so long.
And when they said this tweet is racist, what was that back and forth like?
Well, there really wasn't one. They made that statement, and I kind of scoffed, and I said, you're telling me a tweet about her outfit is racist? And they pretty much ignored my comment and just kept going, and it almost sounded like they were reading off of a script.
Yeah.
So my guess is they had, you know, probably the human resources department draw up this way of firing me and just wanted to get through it because they almost sounded uncomfortable at certain points, but it was also very cold and rather unfeeling. I mean, they didn't even have the decency to bring me in and do it face-to-face, and they didn't have the decency to give me the opportunity to defend myself.
And Larry O'Connor, who's the host of the show that you were a participant on, part of that show, he said what about this?
He's been very outspoken in support of me. He thinks it's a ridiculous and unjust firing. He has been working behind the scenes for a month, and he'll tell you this. He's put it on his Twitter account, trying to get me back on the air, doing anything that he possibly could. And he spoke out on Newsmax yesterday about the situation as well. But they didn't even consult anybody from the show or, as far as I can tell, anyone at WMAL underneath the executive level before they made this decision.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so what have you been doing to stay busy and keep sane?
Right. Well, luckily that was a part-time job for me. Like I said, I was only on the air 2 days a week. So I still have my full-time job at The Spectator. And, you know, when The Spectator got these emails, they actually laughed and deleted them and made fun of the people who were trying to get me in trouble. And I still have my fellowship at the Steamboat Institute, as you mentioned. But ironically enough, over the past 6 months, I've been working on a book, and the topic of the book is the excesses of wokeness and how millennials who graduated from college went on to infiltrate corporate media and push it further to the left. I never thought when I started writing that book that I would be one of the prime examples.
Yeah.
You can interview yourself.
You've got a chapter for all ready to go. So let's talk a little bit about that, because Cumulus also, and we talked about this at the time, Cumulus also put out a memo to their hosts that became public about what they're allowed to and not allowed to talk about with respect to COVID. Like, you know, any COVID misinformation, quote unquote, is a terminable offense. And so you need to essentially be on board with whatever is coming out of the CDC.
Promote the vaccines.
Yeah, that's interesting because I heard whispers of that. I never saw it myself. And when I was on the air, I would talk about potential side effects of the vaccine and talk about my own personal experience of why I was really hesitant to get it. And I never got in trouble for that, which is interesting. I wonder, though, how much of the programming these people actually listen to. My guess is probably not a whole lot.
Now, Amber, did you have to wear?
Unfortunate.
Okay. Did you have to wear colored bracelets? Because they also had that at Cumulus here in Chicago when they let people back in the office. Green means you can come up and talk to me. Yellow means I'm kind of scared. And red means stay away from me. Did you do that?
No, that's crazy. We definitely did not have that. Although the morning drive time show at the DC studio, there were barely any people in the office, so it would be pretty hard to come in contact with somebody, even if you tried. And we were remote for a bit, too. So if we didn't have that, that's crazy.
Well, yeah, no, that's right. I forgot about the color bracelets protocol. That was very public
classic
as well. So I mean, and that you were starting to get to it with the thesis of your book. You know, the Cumulus is supposedly one of the hubs of conservative talk radio. Less and less so, it would appear, both in terms of the content on their airwaves, we know that in Chicago, as well as decision making from the corporate level, like your termination. Speak to that from, you know, your experience at Cumulus and this infiltration you were describing before.
Yeah, I mean, I can only say so much because of some of the confidentiality agreements, but I will say that when I was on some of the internal platforms with the company and receiving emails from some of the corporate executives, I was really horrified as to what type of information was being spread because, you know, like you said, that's supposed to be a host of conservative thought. And clearly the people who are running the outfit don't really agree with any of those values. And I just don't see how it's tenable to have that disconnect between the people who are making all of this money off of the talent, but don't believe in any of the things that they're espousing on the air. It seems like a recipe for disaster. And I think the leftward shift of Cumulus as a corporation certainly contributed to my firing, because if they were getting these emails, they were probably very sympathetic to the people who were sending them in and actually took their claims at face value.
That was my experience in terms of the trajectory of Cumulus when I was at WLS in Chicago. And I'm sorry that happened to you. It's great news for us at Salem Media. We'll just continue to reap the benefits of what Cumulus is doing. But it's unfortunate that you had to be a casualty of what Cumulus has become. Amber Athey, Washington editor for The Spectator, senior Blankley fellow at the Steamboat Institute. And when you wrap up that book, come back and we'll talk about your book.
Sounds awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and we'll see you soon. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was able to put his signed copy of How to Be an Anti-Racist down for just long enough to answer some questions before the House Armed Services Committee the other day. One of them was his estimate as to how long the hostilities between the Russians and the Ukrainians will persist.
That's hard to tell. It's a bit early still, even though we're a month plus into the war. There is much of the ground war left in Ukraine. But I do think this is a very protracted conflict, and I think it's at least measured in years. I don't know about decade, but at least years for sure. This is a very extended conflict that Russia has initiated, and I think that NATO, the United States, Ukraine, and all of the allies and partners that are supporting Ukraine are going to be involved in this for quite some time.
Mm. Well, if it's to be measured in years, not days or months, then are we doing ourselves a disservice by reporting on this like the weather, you know, the daily changes, who's winning and who's losing? To help us with that question, we're pleased to be joined again by Bill Gertz, Washington Times national security correspondent, author of Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. Bill, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hi, good morning.
What about that? What about this, you know, to Russia's winning and advancing its efforts to create a land bridge between Crimea and eastern Ukraine? No, Ukraine has pushed back the Russians out of Kyiv and they're in retreat. Ukraine is winning. Russia is winning. It's a stalemate. This daily update on the status of the combat, how helpful is that?
Well, basically, I think the Ukrainians are proving a lot of the intelligence estimates on this very wrong. I think the Russians assumed they could take over the country in 3 to 5 days, and that was a major miscalculation. Even the Defense Intelligence Agency thought that. And so they were underestimating their Ukrainian resistance and overestimating the Russian military's capabilities. You know, Russia has invested billions of dollars in a military modernization, everything from new tanks to nuclear missiles. It doesn't seem that the Russians really have their conventional military forces in very good shape. Right now, they're making a retreat into Belarus, at least the forces in the middle and northern part of the country, to try and regroup and figure out why they haven't been able to take over the country. So that's the first thing that they're looking at. I think the foreign weapons have been a major boost to the Ukrainians, especially the Javelin anti-tank missiles. This is what has been able to cripple the Russian tank advance, especially on the capital of Kiev.
You know, I understand that, but talk about this in the context of a conflict that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says is going to last years. Tony Blinken can say for every tank they deploy, we're going to send 10 anti-tank missiles. And so what is the expectation we should have about how long we're going to be operating the way we're operating now?
Well, like I said, as long as the Europeans and the U.S. continue to supply weapons to the Ukrainians, there's going to be no easy victory for the Russians, and that's really the key. So then the cost-benefit analysis in Moscow is how long do we keep up this kind of war of attrition? Now, the devastation that's taking place in Ukrainian cities is amazing. I mean, they're just destroying entire cities with attacks on civilians, on apartment buildings. I mean, they're leveling cities in order to kind of force the Ukrainians to surrender, and it doesn't look like the Ukrainians are willing to surrender. Thus, we're going to see years, if not decades, of conflict there.
What if Putin is, you know, taken out or removed or something happens to him? What do you see happening in Ukraine if that does happen?
Well, yeah, there could be that. That would be an earthquake, a political, geopolitical earthquake, if the Russian leader were removed. But he is in firm charge of the levers of power, which are the power ministries, mainly the defense and the FSB, which is the security service. He has tight control over that. There are reports that the Russian leader has been hiding out in a deep underground bunker somewhere within about 40 miles of Moscow. In other words, he's aware that there have been calls for his removal, and he's trying to take steps to make sure that he's not removed. Not only that, he wants to make sure that he's in full control. The military has to be, the military leaders in Russia have to be fairly upset with the way things have gone for them. So if there were some kind of a coup or something, it would probably come from the Russian military.
So now that neither side has achieved what they hope to achieve, Russia, a quick victory, Ukraine to discourage the Russians through their resistance and preventing a quick victory. Now that that doesn't seem to be advancing the flag for some negotiated peace, at least any time in the near term, what are the options the Biden administration has?
Again, they've been leading from behind on this, you know, letting the Europeans take the lead in terms of weapons deliveries. I don't know if they're going to continue the same policies, but, you know, they keep calling for some type of a diplomatic solution, and there really isn't what the diplomatic off-ramp. What are the tools, what are the options to try and convince the Russians that maybe they can, they would be better off not going to war with Ukraine? They haven't figured that out. And the Russian strategy appears, at least the announced strategy, is they're going to move their forces to the eastern part of the country and try to slice off the Donbass and that region while still continuing to push south from Crimea, which they took over back in 2014. So they might try to do some type of petition, but it's really hard to imagine what the ultimate outlook will look like. I mean, as long as the Ukrainians are fighting, I think they got a chance of winning.
Well, is there a play for the United States to try to apply pressure on China to apply pressure on Putin?
Yeah, the Chinese are playing the same kind of double game that they're playing on North Korea, you know, pretending that they're working to try and denuclearize North Korea while at the same time providing them with hypersonic missile technology. The Chinese propaganda network, I think, is the clearest indication that the Chinese are going to full bore in supporting Russia in its efforts to take over Ukraine. Yet at the same time, they're trying to say that they want an end to the conflict. And interestingly enough, they're blaming the United States for the conflict in Ukraine, which is totally outrageous, but really highlights the anti-U.S. nature of the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping.
Walter Russell Mead, writing in the Wall Street Journal about this strategy of pursuing assisting Ukraine with achieving victory. He writes, to force Russia to accept failure in Ukraine, the Biden administration would likely have to shift to a wartime mentality, perhaps including the kind of nuclear brinkmanship not seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. He goes on, with China and Iran both committed to weakening American power by any available means, a confrontation with the revisionist power spearheaded by Russia may prove to be the most arduous challenge faced by an American administration since the height of the Cold War. One, do you agree with Walter Russell Mead? And two, if you do, I mean, do you sense any capacity for this president to go to the mat, as Walter Russell Mead suggests might be required?
Yeah, I don't see that happening. the agenda of the Biden administration is climate change and all of these other left-wing issues that are the main focus of their efforts. So I don't see them shifting to a wartime footing. That said, I do see that the threat of escalation is real. I mean, the Russian military doctrine is escalate to de-escalate. And what that, how that translates is that because their conventional forces are so weak that they're ready to use nuclear weapons much quicker in a conflict. And we're right at that situation now. There have been a lot of talk of whether the Russians would try to use tactical nuclear weapons. We saw them fire one of their new hypersonic cruise missiles, which is, again, a delivery system. They have short-range ballistic missiles, a system called the Iskander, which is also nuclear-capable. So they do have at least 2,000 tactical nuclear weapons, which are not covered by any arms treaty. And that is a real danger, that if things keep going bad for the Russians, that they could apply this new strategy called escalate to de-escalate.
All right. Wow. So if Putin's instinct is, if he's losing, is to escalate, and the Biden administration has no appetite for the brinkmanship that was described, then is there a reason why we wouldn't be talking to the Ukrainians about some kind of partition as the means to peace? I mean, you know, these same political class members certainly talked about partitioning to end the war in Iraq back in the day. Why would that be off the table to try to pressure Zelensky through what we will or won't do to assist the war effort to agree to some sort of partitioning?
Well, I think Zelensky's made clear that he's not going to make any concessions, or if he does, very few concessions. On the other hand, the Biden administration has been projecting weakness, and weakness is provocative. And here, in my Washington Times column out today, I point out that they conducted a hypersonic missile test, the Pentagon, but they did it last month, and they didn't announce it until this week because they were afraid that it would upset the Russians. Similarly, they also canceled a Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile test off the coast of California, again, because they didn't want to upset the Russians. So when you send those signals of weakness, it further encourages aggressors like the Russians to continue their activities. And, of course, I don't see any backing down from Zelensky and the Ukrainians.
Well, so then what are we doing? What is possible here with this administration? It's not what should be done. It's what this administration is willing to do. And with this incoherent approach that we're both describing, what is the play for the Biden administration, for the country? Is it just to continue to try to prop up the Zelensky war effort until you get a different Congress or a different president that's willing to do something different? Because if you're going to project weakness, I mean, Zelensky can project strength all he wants. He doesn't have strength. He doesn't have leverage without weapons from the West. So there's every possibility that you could bring pressure to Zelensky to agree to things he said he wouldn't agree to in the interest of peace. You know, I mean, that there has to be something that this, all this, like, everybody thinks you just continue to talk strong. Strength is, talking strong, I mean, has its limitations. It's the province of the dilettante if you don't have anything that is coherent. And this administration, the Biden administration, is incoherent.
Well, their play is the sanctions. They're hoping that
that's not working.
The sanctions will collapse the Russian economy, and hasn't happened so far. Again, Russia made preparations prior to the conflict to try and cushion its economy from the sanctions, but they keep tightening the sanctions almost on a weekly basis, so we'll have to see how that plays out. But that gives the Ukrainians a lot of leverage. So if the Ukrainians do make some concessions would be to lift some of the sanctions on Russia. But if I don't see the sanctions, as you said, working to force the Russians out of Ukraine. So it is going to be a stalemate for quite some time.
Yeah, and they put sanctions on Putin's two daughters yesterday, and I don't think that's going to move the needle at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, the sanctions are having an impact in Russia, but as long as Europe continues to buy oil and gas from Russia, they're going to still have a way out of their economic problems.
So, I mean, in terms of what our expectation should be with this administration and the world in which we actually live, with the president we actually have, the best we can hope for is a stalemate until we have better leadership from the White House.
What they should be doing is covert action, serious covert action, not just arms deliveries, but covert action inside Russia. And also they need to do information warfare. Again, this is the weakest part of the U.S. national power. We have the best military in the world, but we don't have the kind of information power we have, and yet we're living in an information age. So from my prescription, that's really one of the keys to really winning in the international geopolitical battle space.
So you're saying basically that we should be doing covert action to try to foment an anti-war movement and unrest in Moscow is what you're saying?
Yeah, they have a lot of vulnerabilities that could be exploited with political covert action and other means, other covert means.
He is Bill Gertz, Washington Times national security correspondent. The book, Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. Bill, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.